Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
A few months ago on Open House, we took a deep breath and took on the great taboo of death. And the response to our two conversations that night was simply amazing. It may be the taboo that no one wants to confront or even talk about, but wow, people listen. In a way, it's hardly surprising because it's an issue that impacts exactly 100% of us, and it raises the biggest questions of life. Is this all there is? If that's it, kaput, what has life all been about? And then there's the biggest two-word question, what next? It's a topic we're not afraid to raise and confront on Open House, for within a framework of authentic Christian faith, we can also do it with a sense of hope and clarity. So too tonight's conversation with two men who've written a revealing and very thought-provoking book. It lifts the veil on both what it's really like to stare death in the face and how it happens with people doing it within that framework of faith. The book is The Spiritual Lives of Dying People. And though the title might not sound too cheery, it is packed with 15 deeply moving, compelling stories, lots of insights, experiences, and hope. And there's quite a backstory of how these two authors came together. The authors are John Mulder, a Presbyterian minister who's joined us previously on Open House, and Father Paul Scaglione, a Roman Catholic priest, and they both join us now on Open House. John and Paul, welcome.
Welcome. Oh, that's good. Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Paul, I'd like to start with you and ask you to take us through your mum's story, because she had a powerful impact on you, both reshaping you personally and in your faith.
Yes, my mother had a very important role to play in my own life, and it can easily be said that her experience was one that led me to understand that all the things I learned in theology books weren't necessarily true. My mother, at the age of 47, was cleaning her house, taking down drapes, and she felt a little uneasy and took herself to her bedroom and lay down, took a couple of aspirin, lay down for a while, and never got up out of that bed again to walk. In a matter of an hour or so, she was paralyzed from the waist down. When all of us in the family were shocked by that, we didn't know what to do with that. We all were terrified by what happened because we didn't know exactly what had caused this. And to make a long story shorter, we went through this normal process of most people dealing with tragedy, is that we search for answers everywhere. So went to endless number of doctors. All of us continued to kind of pray that somehow God would change all things. We were pretty steadfast in our belief, because doctors were so uneasy about a diagnosis, that maybe it was something temporary. So we kept our prayer life, for the most part, fixed on allowing our prayer to kind of influence God to change things back to the way they were, which I think is a pretty common experience with most people.
Yes.
Particularly when you're dealing with a tragedy of a loved one. And that prayer was very loud and boisterous and animated in an Italian family and through the extended family with friends and everyone else. But it was a prolonged experience, so it went on for years. And in the course of those years, my mother had taken the habit of writing these little plaques of paper that she would put in different rooms of the house that had written in black ink the word walk. And she had them all over through the house. And we said, well, that's fine, because that's what we're praying for, that she would walk. Well, the revelation came to me of something changed radically when, after 7 years of doing this, and 7 years of my bargaining with God that I would give up anything in my own life for her to walk again, I came home one day and all the signs were gone. And with all the signs gone, I was totally confused. I thought, well, maybe she took them down to make new ones. So I went to my mother, who I always called Mommy. I said, Mommy, I said, well, why are the signs down? What happened? You know, you took them down. I said, you're making new ones? And she said, oh, no, Paul. She said, I don't need them anymore. I said, what do you mean you don't need them anymore? I said, we've been doing this for 7 years. What do you mean you don't need them anymore? Oh, Paul, she said, I've been praying for the wrong thing. I said, what do you mean? You don't want to walk? No, no, no. She said, I still want to walk. She said, but I've been praying for the wrong thing. I've been praying that God would turn the clock back and put me back where I was 7 years ago. and it's never going to happen. I said, well, how do you know? God could work a miracle. She said, no, it's not going to be that way. She said, anyway, I'm already healed. I said, now you really got me confused. I said, you're still in the same wheelchair, you're still paralyzed, and now you're telling me you're already healed. So what are you talking about? Will you please help me? So she said, look, the more I kept praying to walk, the more I kept ignoring God's presence in my life right now. I began to understand that I was praying for the wrong thing. Instead of praying to walk, I should have been praying to be able to see God more clearly in my life right now. And she said, I've seen it in you. I've seen it in your father, your brother, your sister, my sisters, the extended family, everybody that's been praying for it. I finally have come to understand that I am healed because these relationships that are so important to me are the things that are sustaining me in love.
What an amazing insight.
She's, well, you know, a high school graduate. She didn't have any sophistication in terms of theology, but she was much more wise than I was. And her wisdom came out of her experience. And that was the key for me. I was in touch with her understanding that she could seek and know God's presence in her experience. Then my whole focus changed in terms of how healing happens. It happens in the human experience itself. It doesn't happen outside. It's not like God, this great, powerful entity somewhere beyond, kind of intervenes intermittently and arbitrarily with some people and not with others. It's kind of like playing a game in prayer.
Yeah.
So what I started to understand was what my mother taught me, which was, God's with you now. God's with me now. God's with us now. And even though I would love to walk, I've been healed because I now can focus on seeing God present here and all of you.
And of the many things that you learned through that whole experience, one of the most significant was the value of listening, which then led you to set up a retreat for dying people.
Right, and that retreat became an important part for people who, like my mother, had chronic, not necessarily life-threatening in the immediate situation, but long-term. Because I found a lot of people, as I was pastoring churches, who were homebound, couldn't get out to go to a retreat center or some place of prayer. So we organized a retreat with some friends in the parish to accompany these people to a retreat house, provide a nursing staff, everything that they would need to be cared for, so that they could hear and pray and listen to God speak to them. Because I was convinced after my mother's story that God wants to communicate something, but if we're not listening, it's never going to happen.
Because we're so often so busy talking and not listening.
Right, and preoccupied with the maintenance of our diseases. That's what happens in chronic illness. That's where all their time and attention goes, you know? So you have people that come from the outside in who are good professional caregivers. I have the greatest respect for doctors and nurses and anyone else that offers care. But, you know, when people are doing something for you as a task, you're preoccupied with the whole phenomena of the time that gets consumed and having that task happen. It doesn't give you time or room to pray. So what the retreat was removing people from that normal situation, putting them in a different environment, and allow their heart to be open to what God might say to them because they're in a new and a freer environment.
Let me add a footnote to this matter of the retreat and Paul's capacity to listen. I went on one of these retreats as an observer, and one of the things he says, and it's one of his favorite quotations, comes from Pope John the 23rd, who said, the greatest challenge of the spiritual life is not to give love, but to receive love. And that line, as he has told these stories, it seems to completely stop people. They don't know what to make of that. Something so arresting, because we spend our lives so much trying in some fashion to shape our environments, to control our lives, to give to other people and all the rest, and we don't take time to receive, be open to the presence of God. And that's what those retreats really are, just helping people to open up.
John, can I ask you how you first came into contact with Paul? Because there's quite a story there. You were in ministry, very intensely in ministry. It was overcooked, too much speaking, no listening, and then came a crash.
I crashed, part of it was due to bipolar illness. Part of it was a pattern of drinking that had turned into full-blown alcoholism. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, morally, I was just wrung out. And I'll never forget the first time I talked with him. I just talked all the time for an entire hour. And finally, Paul said, well, our time is up, and I'd like you to go home and reflect on the verse from the Psalms, be still and know that I am God, which was exactly what I needed to hear, and which was almost impossible for me to do because I was still caught up in the sound of my own voice and my own words that would come from the keyboard of my computer and all the rest. It was very, very difficult at first. That was very, very painful and wrenching for me to just sit there sometimes in my study or lie there at bed at night and not to try to formulate everything myself, but to listen, just to be still. That was an enormously difficult experience.
And a huge lesson for all of us, me included especially. Can I ask you both then, how and why this book, The Spiritual Lives of Dying People, came into existence?
As John just mentioned, he went on one of the retreats and he was very touched by what he saw happen on the retreat and some of the stories that are in the book and some others that I had mentioned to him in general conversation. So I had always been asked by other people to claim, why don't you write a book? I don't have the patience to do it. But John offered to say, well, how about we do it this way? Why don't you tell the stories? I'll transcribe them and put them in a text, and we can edit the text and put it together. Maybe we could compose a book. So I said, well, I don't know if you say so. I don't know, because I really don't know what I'm doing here. But that's how it came to be. I really didn't want to write a book. But John's encouragement allowed me to tell the stories, and the book became the product.
Paul, to those who think it might be just too morbid by far to consider reading the stories of dying people, what would you say to them?
I tell them to read the second title, which is Testimonies of Hope and Courage, because yes, the stories really are remarkable stories of the wisdom and the hope that springs up out of people, kind of like what I learned from my mother. She learned a wisdom coming out of her experience, and that's really what I think sets the book off. It doesn't get into the philosophical questions about why this is happening. Rather, it seeks to hear the message of a person going through this experience, discovering God, and this becomes a hope and an encouragement for them in their suffering and in their transition from this life to the next.
So if that's a reality, and it is very powerfully a reality in your book, why do you think death is such a taboo for the living, especially for those doing life seemingly well and in a healthy way?
You know, I struggle with that, but I remember reading a book years ago, Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, and he said that every culture has this fear of dying, and so they have to come up with some system of meaning about it. I mean, we invest so much in our life as it is, with relationships, with possessions, with all the things that bring us some sort of comfort. To think of the end of that is, I mean, that's difficult. It's very difficult. But to think of nothing after it, for me, is more difficult. If the world were simply created around the environment in which I see people spending their time, with nothing beyond that, then it lacks meaning for me. So for me, and for I think some people that, as believers, part of the experience is it gives purpose and meaning to life, to say that my spirit, my life, my soul, however, whatever language you want to use, continues beyond this. How I live is really going to be reflected in what happens afterwards as well. So I want to live a life that is hopefully healing and consoling and comforting to others, because I believe that's what the continuation would be.
Yes, you say that that biggest question is, what is the purpose of all this? And so many questions are raised confronting the reality of death, but you say that's the biggest one. What's the purpose
of
all this?
Yes, that's it.
Hey, let me jump in here. I wanted to add one thing that I thought was absolutely fascinating as I began to work through all these stories, and that is that the fear that people have as they approach death is the end of relationships. or problematic relationships that they've had in their lives, relationships with parents, with siblings, with close friends, people that they have hurt, people that they have betrayed one way or another. And what Paul is able to do principally by establishing a relationship with these people, a relationship of trust and of caring, is to give them the confidence that in this life to come, there will be relationships that will be renewed and relationships governed by love rather than fear. And it came out most dramatically to me when I pushed him on the issue of, well, what happens after death? You run into the priest who abused you as a boy. And he said, it will not be the same person. I will be different, and he will be different, and we will be living in an entirely different kind of relationship determined by redemption rather than punishment.
Paul, you say that those who seem to die well, and that's a very familiar phrase, those are the people who've been most honest about their life. How are they demonstrating that honesty?
Well, in the people that I've been with, they demonstrate the honesty by being able to review their life and look at it and understand that there's many, many things that happen in life that we regret later. We wish we could turn the clock back and do things over. And I think people that are caring to themselves, really extending care to themselves, allow them to go back to those moments and not look at them as problems, but look at them as opportunities to change kind of an attitude that they still have inside themselves that needs to be healed. You know, I have one story in the book of a woman who did that quite dramatically, and I think that's really what people want. They want a healing, and John's right. This is about relationships. Care is really about eternal relationships that have root here that continue beyond. So if I were to meet someone later, you know, after my death, who I knew in this life, I'm going to know them as the redeemed person that they are. I'm not going to know them in all their unfinished business here. I mean, that would be hell.
Yes.
And hell, I don't want to go there.
Don't want to go there.
So I want it to be as a place where I am in the company of others who are in the company of God, who's healed us and brought us home.
Can I ask you each, and this is going to be a big challenge, to identify one story each of these 15 compelling, moving stories, and explain that story and its importance to us. Can I start with you, Paul?
I think I'll use the one that's most important to me, and that's about my brother, Charlie. Charlie died just 2 years ago, and he died from bone cancer, but he had also had other diseases, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis. He had had bypass surgery, triple bypass, at the age of 33. My brother was a tough kid. You wouldn't think of him to be kind of religious type, but in the course of his life as he got older, after college, he began to try to seek out God in his life, and he developed a very powerful personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And in the course of doing that, he would pray, kind of like my mother, you know, pray that things would get better. He would always ask me to pray for him, you know, and things like that, in which I would naturally do. But there was always in Charlie a great sense of, it's the relationship I have with Jesus and he has with me that is most important, regardless of what pain and suffering I have. But that was almost secondary. And I remember just being with him 2 months before he died. He was visiting at my home, and he came upstairs from the bedroom, opened up his medicine chest, and he poured out a fistful of pills that he was taking every day. By this time, he was on morphine because of his cancer. And I said, Charlie, how do you do that? And he says, well, I do what needs to be done. He says, but you know, ultimately, this will all end, and I'll be in the presence of Jesus forever, who I've always wished to be with, so I can make it through. And it's that kind of testimony. I've been in tears over my brother for years, but that really, probably more than any other of the stories, had an impact on me beyond anything else. He was a devout person, but it was the relationship that was the key, because it also set up relationships for him in his family and in his church community that sustained him.
And demonstrated hope.
Absolutely.
John, can I ask you, of the 15 stories that you've detailed in the book, what story stands out for you most?
Well, I think the one that really fascinated me, because it's such a poignant story about the person involved, but it's also a powerful description of Paul's life as a priest and what he tries to do with people who are dying. This is a story of a relatively young man who, at the very, very beginning of the AIDS crisis, is diagnosed with AIDS. He's put in essentially into a kind of isolation ward so that neither the hospital staff nor Paul nor anybody else can actually get into his room, and they have to speak over intercoms and things like that. And this young man is very, very angry that God has been horrible to him in his life. He feels that his disease is a judgment on him because of his homosexuality. And he is a very, very angry man and lets loose on Paul for God's injustice to him and the fact that God didn't protect him from AIDS and all the rest. As he vents to Paul, he also begins to come to terms with his own uncertainty about the wisdom of his own actions. It's clear he was highly promiscuous, involved in the first wave of gay activity, which really encouraged more and more partners, and comes to terms with the fact that maybe he actually passed it on to somebody else, and he then begins to feel terrible guilt about that. What's fascinating about his relationship to Paul is that he swings all over the map. One time he's quiet and reflective, the next time he's belligerent and angry, and it goes up and down and up and down. But as he begins to vent, it becomes clear that one of the things that he held on to from his boyhood in the church was the image of Jesus as a good shepherd. There was a statue in the sanctuary of his Catholic church, Jesus as the good shepherd. And as he moves deeper and deeper into his AIDS crisis, he begins to grasp at the image of this welcoming, loving Jesus who will care for him as a shepherd cares for his sheep. And Paul lets this all happen, just listens and walks with him all the way until he dies. Then there's this big crisis about, is there going to be a funeral, where the funeral should be held, and on and on and on. And the family is involved. The parents are still deeply conflicted over their son's homosexuality and the shame of his having AIDS. And the sister is much more supportive and helpful. And finally, Paul does the funeral. This is in a town separate from where he is actually serving. And he does it quietly and goes home, caring for the family as best he can. And he told me he debated about whether he should tell his church about the fact that he had ministered to a man who had died of AIDS. And then he decided, no, this is my ministry. This is what I need to do for God and for him. It's a story that filled me with enormous anguish over this young man who died so painfully, and yet the triumph of hope and courage that emerged finally at the end, because Paul was willing to stay with him and help him see the Jesus that he knew as the good shepherd in the statue of the church of his home.
Which is why this is such an important book to read. Paul, can I finish by asking you about one piece of wisdom and one quote that you mention in an interview that John conducts with you at the end of the book? You say, dying is coming to the reality that life in this body is terminal, not infinite, but finite. And you quote C.S. Lewis, who says, it's not that we have a soul, we actually are a soul, and we have a body. Tell us why you think that's such great wisdom.
For me, it's the wisdom that's born out of just the fact of what it is to be human. Everyone dies. You know, it's one of those bald-faced realities that a lot of people might struggle with, but it is the reality. And I can live my life with some generosity and purpose, but I can live it fuller, with a fuller sense, if I know that my life is connected to others who have gone before me, too, and that I will reconnect with them. I pastored in an African-American church here in the States that used to call, and still does, calls its funerals homegoings. And that makes sense to me, because what lives eternally for me is not something that is as factual as my body. What lives within me is a spirit that's been created by God that goes home, not just to God, but to all those that I've had a relationship with in love. That's what it means for me. It's that sense of, like, there has to be something more than just our being able to say, my life is what I've created here. That's not enough for me.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, where they were saying, C.S. Lewis, quote, made sense to me. We're already connected to God. We're already on the process of going home. Whether we're consciously aware of it or not, it's happening. It's what Augustine said. Our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And I firmly believe that.
It's great wisdom and a great lesson to 100% of us, Paul Scaglione and John Mulder. I'm so glad you've joined us on Open House. It's an important book, The Spiritual Lives of Dying People. And not forgetting the subtitle, Testimonies of Hope and Courage. John and Paul, thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House. We'll put the details of the book up on our Open House community Facebook page. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.